Lee had no fear.
We're bringing you an exclusive first listen of a special interview with Muhammad Ali's former business manager here at First this bank holiday Sunday at 7 p.m.
OTB Sports Radio, live 24/7 on the Go Loud app. The OTB Podcast Network.
It's Lance Armstrong week here on OTB.
Are you a complete rookie?
OTB Gold.
Listen to our interviews with the people closest to his story on the OTB Podcast Network.
Are you crazy?
A cycling special for you this morning. We've got Tyler Hamilton with us. Tyler, how the hell are you?
I'm doing well.
Welcome to Ireland.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, it's great to be here.
People might have seen a blur of a super fast cyclist along the West Coast over the last couple of days. You've been incognito checking out our roads.
I was checking out your roads. I don't think it was a blur, though. Yeah, I ride pretty slow these days. But yeah, I flew in last week, took the train over to Galway, and found this route called the Wild
Atlantic Way.
Yeah, and it was awesome. I rode up to the north and just fell in love with this place.
Yeah, that's good.
But people were super friendly. Roads were spectacular.
Any cycling fans?
Yeah, I want to come back.
Did you get recognized by the cycling fans, or was it?
I was pretty low key. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I kind of looked like a Joey, so to speak, out there. I was on a rental bike and kind of an upright sort of hybrid type bike.
Right.
And I just went from hotel to hotel. I even had my camping gear, so I camped out one night.
Very nice.
Yeah.
And the weather was okay. It played ball.
Yeah. The night I camped out, it rained sideways. But it was a lot of fun. It was a good experience, yeah. I definitely want to come back and maybe someday do the whole thing.
Yeah, yeah. No,
maybe get a group of people to do it and raise some money for a good cause.
Yeah, well, we would definitely be happy to help out with that. The Wild Atlantic Way people would be only too delighted to. A little bit.
Yeah.
You don't have to do the whole thing. We'll do a little section. You can come in for a section.
Well, we could actually practice in advance so that we're actually capable of doing the whole thing. So
I'll coach you.
Yeah, well, that sounds great.
Okay. Paniagua, though.
Yeah, Paniagua, totally. That's what you do these days, right? You kind of teach people to
cycle. I coach people, I do a couple of different things, but that's one of the things I do.
The other thing I think that you do is you tell people your story and you tell people your truth.
Yeah.
Which I guess at some point gets a bit easier and easier and easier.
Yeah.
Or is it always difficult to revisit?
It's always a little bit difficult, but it has gotten a little bit easier, I would say. The beginning was really tough. It was really tough. Every time I do it, it brings me back into the moment for sure. You feel the emotions and, it was a dark part of my life for sure.
Yeah.
Even at the best of times, it was pretty dark.
There's two sides to that, right? There's the bit where you ultimately have the truth slowly come out and kind of, it feels to me it's a bit like peeling an onion, that there's layers and layers and layers, and that at various stages you kind of feel like you made a breakthrough, and then you realize, I've got a little bit more that I need to show people.
Sure.
Yeah, I'm clear now. It's like, those last few people that I haven't told exactly everything to.
Yeah.
But then there's also that thing that you've talked about, even at your best moments, like there's this emptiness.
Yeah.
Because you don't fully believe in yourself.
Yeah, standing on the podium in the Olympic Games, on the top step of the podium, gold medal. Didn't feel like it should have, That's wrong, But you should never feel that way. Well, I certainly did.
How did it feel? How would you
Yeah, a little bit
it?
Empty. Obviously, it's still exciting, but I dreamed my whole life of winning a gold medal in any sport, really. I remember watching the Olympic Games in 1980. They were in Lake Placid in the Winter Olympics. And I remember watching the U.S. team win the hockey finals. And then, I remember Eric Heiden winning the 5 gold medals in speed skating, and I was like, that's what I want to do,
Because you were a skier first.
Yeah, I was a ski racer, downhill ski racer.
Yeah.
Yep. And then, fast forward, 20 years, and there, 25 years, and there I am in Athens. And it didn't feel anything like it should have, for sure.
The level of excitement that you felt, obviously, because, you're talking about phone calls are coming in, the talk shows want you, people are paying you money just to kind of stand in their corporate area, and you're like, I'll take the checks and I'll rub shoulders with them. How long does that kind of mask the fact that there's something inside where you're going, something's wrong here?
But, you just keep going. We just, life was so 100 miles an hour at that time. You just kept those feelings would pop up. I called them, they'd pop up sometimes in the middle of the night. So I'd be looking at the ceiling, between 2 and 3 in the morning. I called them committee meetings, And you think about it, but then you just bury those feelings and, keep nose to the grindstone, keep going. But eventually, yeah, eventually I had to deal with it all. You know, I had to deal with the truth. I had to deal with, you know, what it did to me personally, like on the inside. And yeah, it was hard. I went through, you know, kind of a dark period for a while.
Yeah. Yeah. After the truth came out?
Yeah. Well, before, certainly for a while, you know, I got caught and I lied about it for a long time. I thought I was doing it for the right reasons, you know, for myself, for my teammates, for the whole Peloton, the whole secret, you know, keeping that secret going. Keep, you know, it was the code of the Omerta.
Yeah.
Code of silence. So I was prepared to go to the grave with my secrets. You know, I didn't want to be the guy telling the truth. And, you know, it took a grand jury subpoena to, you know, get, I basically backed up and backed up and backed up. And I was either jump off the cliff or tell the truth.
You say jump off the cliff, and it's not a turn of phrase for you, because you had, you'd suffered from depression throughout your life.
Yeah, yeah. And I had suicidal thoughts. I was a mess inside, trying to bury the truth. And then getting subpoenaed and having to tell the truth in front of the grand jury was the best thing that ever happened to me. So I went into this like Los Angeles courtroom and with like a 100-pound backpack on. When I came out, it was gone, and it was like. Yeah, I had plenty of stuff to deal with after that. You know, a lot of the fallout from everything. But, you know, my life changed completely.
You talk about going to therapy in the book. Did you only get to that point where you were engaged in therapy after that? Or
no, I started, when my career was at the highest point.
And did you tell your therapist that you were a cheat?
No.
So yeah, even
I
in therapy,
I lied to him.
That's mad, isn't it?
I was a good liar. I was a good liar.
When you think about that, it's like
my parents, my therapist. Yeah.
I mean, I can understand the parents, right? Because like that's a very big leap to go, and so there's literally only your wife at the start.
Yeah, she knew.
And then, but even your therapist is supposed to be the safe space. It's like,
yeah, right.
So I'm going through some stuff here. I just need to tell you this thing.
Right.
So that's kind of an indication of how crazy the whole thing.
It was crazy. I know. I couldn't even tell my therapist, or, you know, I should have. And, but no, it was just eating me up inside, big time. And as soon as I told the truth, yeah, life hasn't been all roses, but it's been a lot, it's gotten so much better. So much better. Now I don't have to lie anymore. Now I don't have to make up lies to cover up the lie.
Yeah.
And like, the more you lie, the more you have to make up lies to cover up the lies. And like, and then you have two lives going on at the same time. And it might look good from the outside, but on the inside, I was a mess. Yeah. And then, yeah, I was fortunate that I got the opportunity to tell the truth. You know, I felt like I was 10 years too late to tell the truth.
Yeah.
Like, way beyond that opportunity. But I did tell the truth, and, you know, so many people forgave me, like, straight away. You know, obviously, they were disappointed, but...
Well, I think there's...
You know, it's a good lesson in life.
I think it's clear that there are good dopers and bad dopers. The good dopers are the ones who go chapter and verse. This is how it happened. This is who it happened with. This is why it happened. This is the details on it. The bad dopers are like, well, everybody else is doing it, so I mean, it's not that big a deal. Screw you, I'm not telling you. And like it seems like the ones who tell the truth, actually, whatever their motivation is, the impact is that it has a benefit for the sport, that it actually helps people learn about the how and the why and how screwed up these sports are.
Yeah. I mean, I feel that's one of my big motivations is to, you know, tell as many people who will listen just so it doesn't happen to them. You know, I wish I had heard a story like mine before I got into this crazy sport of cycling. You know, it was rotten to its core at the time. And, I made some poor decisions for sure. A lot of them. But, you know, the cards were definitely stacked against me.
Like you detail very well in the book and in other interviews, the decision to actually dope in the first place, because essentially it's the competitive edge really is the underlying driver of all of this. It's outside influences, it's Lance, etc. But at what point do you realize that to become a successful cheater, you then need to become a successful liar? And what did you feel at that point when you started to realize that you have to live this double life?
I remember, I think it was after the 98 tour. You know, there was a Festina affair. And I remember coming back at the end of that season back to the States and my dad asking me about it. And he asked me if I'd ever doped. Straight away, no. You know, like didn't even have to think about it, you know. I was like, wow, I've become a good liar. And that was probably the hardest lie. And then after that, it became easier and easier. And all of a sudden, like, these two lives just kind of came about. And yeah.
Are you constantly out of body looking at yourself going, whoa, shut up, stop saying that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, again, those committee meetings, I call them in the middle of the night. Yeah, you'd sit there and look at the ceiling and think about just all the lying you had to do. Like, you know, how much longer can I do this? You know, am I going to get caught? That my biggest fear was, am I going to get caught? You know, I thought way more about that than I thought about winning, you know, which is pretty crazy.
Well, let's talk about 2004, because that's the year that you do ultimately get caught.
Yeah.
In retrospect, it looks a bit like you wanted to get caught in some ways, because there's a warning from the UCI. It's like, here, listen, come in here. You're doing really well. We're a bit suspicious of you.
Yeah.
Your values are a little bit high. You're not getting popped, but we're coming for you. And then afterwards, in Athens, the A sample tests positive.
Yeah.
The B sample gets frozen. So on a technicality, you're like, I'm keeping this medal.
Yeah.
And then the third time later on, when they're like, you've got somebody else's blood in your veins there.
Yeah.
How the hell did that happen?
Yeah.
And that's what you get popped for in the end.
Yeah.
Do you feel in retrospect that somewhere along the way, you're like subconsciously going, I'm going to do this and the house of cards is coming down? Or was it just a screw up?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I was blood doping. I wasn't blood doping with somebody else's blood. So in my defense, I was like, I was fighting the right fight. It was like I had robbed those banks, but not this one.
Okay.
You know, that's how I felt. But
how did they catch you?
I wish I'd told the truth back then. I mean, I would have saved myself years and years and years of pain. Like, I mean, after that, my life just changed. When I had that positive test, my life just went straight downhill. You know, I was down in the dumps for years and years and years and just suffered like a dog until I got subpoenaed and had to go in front of the grand jury. And then I was finally able to tell the truth. You know, I didn't have to live by the code of the Omerta anymore. And
So you didn't unintentionally
take somebody else's blood?
No, and so it wasn't on purpose, somewhere in your subconscious at all?
It was a screw up. I don't know. You know, I worked with this doctor named Ufemiano Fuentes. Possibly there was a mix-up in the blood bags. I don't know.
He had a very...
He hasn't told me yet.
Yeah, okay.
You can try to call him.
It's a very strange mistake for somebody who is so meticulous about these sort of things and so secretive with their records, and I guess to a certain extent has survived the full extent, perhaps, of what might have been coming down the tracks in terms of punishment to him, for him to make an error like that.
Yeah, I don't know. We can try to call him and we can ask him.
So it wasn't, I wondered if maybe you'd kind of at some point reached that stage where you're like, okay, I'm going to keep going here. Wouldn't it be great if I actually got caught somewhere? One of those
It was a blessing in disguise for sure. It was time. Like, I feel like had I not been caught, it would have continued. Well, I would have continued blood doping and taking EPO and lying to everybody, including my family.
And if you don't.
Living a double life and all that. Sure, I was down in the dumps for years, but at least I didn't have to dope anymore and just.
Yeah.
It was over. Maybe it would have been better I got caught earlier.
If you don't get the grand jury summons, do you feel like you would still be part of the Omerta?
Maybe. I mean, that's how strongly I felt. Like, I was so still, even though I was out of the sport, I was still, I don't know, I was pretty twisted inside. Like, I you know, I'm a Bostonian. I grew up in Boston. I'm pretty tough. And, you know, you have a secret. You're doing it for all your buddies.
You take it
to the grave. You take it to the grave.
Then. Yeah.
You know, I didn't want to screw up anybody else's life, even though mine was already messed up. Like, I didn't want to mess up anybody else's life. And I knew if I told the truth, I was going to have to tell the whole truth. And the whole truth was ugly. Ugly. But finally, you know, push came to shove, and it was like, I had to tell the truth. And, you know, it was a gift. It was a huge gift.
Does it feel therapeutic even now to
talk about it? Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
I mean, I get goosebumps just thinking about it.
Because you
talking about it. Yeah, it was huge, huge. I mean, it's changed my life. I don't know where I'd be today or even if I'd be around today if I didn't tell the truth.
When you think about the...
Yeah, and this changed my life too, you know? Just sitting there for 2.5 years with Dan Coyle writing this book. And, you know, Dan Coyle was almost like my therapist, you know? And when I first started talking to him, you know, we did like over 60 interviews, and it was like the information was just trickling out of me. You know, by the end of it, it was just pouring out of me, you know, both faucets on.
Yeah, because you needed to.
I needed to, and it was just like, oh yeah, and another thing, and another thing, and another thing, yeah.
When you look back at the cyclists who have died through suicide or overdoses or like, I mean.
Could have been me.
So easily.
So easily.
And that's the bit here that I think people shouldn't lose sight of, that like the decision to tell the truth, it's brilliant that it was forced on you, because outside agencies sometimes need to intervene and help and say,
for sure,
okay, we're just going to have a little word here, and at the end of this, it's all going to be okay.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. I wish when I first got caught that they kind of came in a little softer and, hey, let's think about this here. But it was more like, okay, do it or did you do it or not? Like, you know, I feel like I wasn't really given just a little bit of time to take a step back, think about it.
In 04, the first time they coached
you. I've even told you that USADA, United States Anti-Doping, like maybe they should give somebody a little bit more time before when they're first told that they have a positive test to think about it. Or maybe somebody comes in, maybe somebody like me to come talk to them. You know?
Yeah.
I wish
you could be the
talk to myself.
News. Hello, I'm
just, you know, it's not the end of the world. Like, we all make mistakes, some bigger than others, you know? And I'm a good person, you know? I have two great parents who told me the difference between right and wrong. You know, I knew from the beginning that what I was doing was wrong. But for whatever, I got caught up in it, and then it got bigger and bigger and bigger as the years went on, and then you felt a stronger bond, not only with your team and the staff, but just the whole Peloton. And, you know, had I told the whole truth in 2004, I don't know what would have happened. Might have been good for me personally. I probably would have been bulldozed by certain individuals, but I would have blown up the sport.
But you might not have been ready for it either. You might
wasn't ready for it. I was certain by the time I got subpoenaed, and I was ready for it, you know. Yeah. Even though I didn't want it, I still wanted to. I waited to the last second, you know. First, they asked if I'd come in as they call it a proffer, where you can come in with your lawyer by your side. But they called it voluntary. And I was like, nope, I'm not volunteering to do that. So it's just, I was still, you know, hard headed. And
yeah. This is 2010.
You know, whatever, the Omerta, like I was caught up in it, you know. I was, you know, and it still exists today a bit, you know. But I'm glad I'm not a part of it anymore.
Do you think it would have been a successful case had you actually spoken out in 2004? Or I don't want to call it a successful case because it hasn't been fully successful, but at least you had six more years, and you talk about certain individuals. I mean, you had six more years, or the authorities had six more years to gather evidence on Lance Armstrong.
Yeah. I mean, I think it was the timing. You know, Floyd Landis came out. Mm. That, you know, who knows if, you know, Floyd hadn't come out. He really kind of got the ball rolling. And I'm grateful to him for that, for sure.
I want to talk about Floyd, because without
him, you know,
he finally
hit the wall and just said, I'm telling the truth, and, you know, good on him.
He needed you as well, though, because he's like
I think I helped him. And
he's a lone crank.
Yeah.
If that's the way the media publish it, it's like, well, sorry, that's the way that Armstrong and everybody else attacks him. It's like, oh, look at this guy. You can't trust him. He's temperamental. Yeah. But when it's him and you, it's like, there's a corroborating second source on a lot of this information here, and they all seem to be telling exactly the same story. It's a kind of coincidental thing that it's hard for everybody to deny.
Right.
It was
good timing. I think in 2004 it would have been, you know, there would have been some people that believed me, and I think there would have been a lot of people that didn't believe me.
You were really good mates with Floyd. You go on... you know, it's brave for him to go on a cycle with you around Girona, because he's effectively replaced you in Lance's affections, and now you're a rival for Lance. And Lance, I'm sure, was looking at him, if he'd heard about it, which no doubt he did. Was like, what are you doing hanging out with that guy?
Yeah,
we're supposed to be enemies now. So you obviously liked Floyd, but you must have had some sense that in him there was the potential, when he gets caught, to bring the whole thing down.
It didn't totally surprise me. Yeah. Floyd's a good guy. He's a good guy. You know, he's made some poor decisions like myself. But yeah, I always really enjoyed my time with him. Really funny guy. Yep. But he's got a huge heart, big heart.
And when he goes public, are you kind of like, yeah, okay. Yeah.
I was a little bit nervous, like, wow, it's coming down. And I, you know, sure enough, I get a call from federal investigator, Jeff Nowitzki. He investigated Barry Bonds back in the day, the baseball player.
The whole Balco thing.
So, yeah, and I, you know, if you look at Jeff Nowitzki, you know, very tall, intimidating character.
6'7" and bald.
Yeah. But, you know, I owe him a lot. I mean, I feel lucky to have, I got that phone call, for sure. And, you know, I gave him every answer he and then some. Gave him information on every question he had.
It felt like when you get subpoenaed, it was kind of like this outpouring of emotion from you. You felt things you didn't expect to feel. Did Floyd feel the same way? Did he have a similar reaction? When obviously he was voluntary with
I don't know. Floyd and I haven't talked in a while. Just there was a big big trial up till last week. So, and due to the fact that I was a witness, I didn't really want to talk to either side. So.
I mean, when Floyd first of all comes out with that information, is it therapeutic in a way for him, kind of like it was for you?
Yeah, I'm sure it was. I'm sure it was. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, his whole life has changed too since telling the truth. For sure. For sure. And you got to be so happy for him.
Yeah. Absolutely, and he's got his own interesting business going on.
And good for him.
Yeah,
good
totally. That's the three of you there at one stage on screen. All looking a bit younger at this point.
Yeah.
What jersey are you in at that point?
That's Rock and Republic.
So this is early on?
That's later.
Okay.
That's like 2008 or something.
Okay, so at that point, you guys were barely speaking to each other.
We were probably just,
That smile for the cameras.
Yeah, those are fake smiles.
Yeah. There was a lot of that going on.
Yeah.
You mentioned the case up until recently. It's hard for us as outsiders to feel anything other than Lance at the end has lost his reputation, has lost a lot of his standing in world sport, but has kept most of the money. So I'd say if you were to ask Lance, he kind of feels like he's doing all right.
I don't know. I haven't talked to him in a long time. It's too bad that case... that case didn't go to trial. I mean, on the short term, it was nice for me because I got to come to Ireland early and I got to go check out the Western Coast, which was beautiful. And I'll definitely come back. But long term, I think it was, it would have been in the media for a month, it would have been a long trial. And we would have learned a lot about the culture of the sport back then.
Yeah.
We're not talking just about Lance or about, it would have been ugly for probably all of us. But we would have learned a lot about the sport back then, and I think we would have gotten a lot more answers. It would have been in the media every day. It would have created a lot of dialogue every day, and we're not going to get that. And you would have heard, testimonies from each of these individuals. I think it would have eventually pushed other people that haven't, come to terms with the truth to come out and tell the truth.
Because there's a lot of
choice. There's plenty of those guys.
Yeah.
There's plenty of people that haven't told the truth, and I'm not saying everybody needs to come out and tell the truth, but... we don't have all the, we've only heard this much of the past.
Yeah.
And there's a lot more out there. And if we don't really learn from what the mistakes we made in the past, it's going to happen again.
I feel like they do need to come out and tell their story.
Well,
because,
what are we going to do now? Now everything's been settled. It's like, now it's just going to be, it's kind of buried and now we're moving forward. But, if not, I say let's get a big round table thing going. Whoever, leave the egos at the door, come in and just talk about it. Right.
But that's why I would classify Lance as the bad doper, because he's like, oh no, I've got a new podcast. It's called Forward. I'm forgetting that. That's all in the past. I'm done talking about that. No need for me to explain how, why, when, how much, what Ferrari gave me. Was I using a motor? Oh, you can have all your suspicions all you want, but I'm not going to tell you because why would I tell you? Whereas actually, if we had the case, he would have been on the trial answering questions that we asked him. Did you use a motor? What's the difference between using a motor and taking drugs? Why is that a worse form of cheating than this other form of cheating? All that kind of stuff. And it feels like sport has missed out, that the whole value of sport has missed out by that trial and by the original federal trial not going ahead.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know what else they can do now just in terms of getting people together to come out and tell the truth or talk more about the truth. But I wish there was something we could do, maybe... You could organize something. I'll be the first on your list.
We do.
But really, and get guys from the 80s who doped. It didn't start in 1993 when Lance arrived. It didn't start in 1997 when I arrived. It had been going on a long time. When I arrived in 1997 to the big leagues of this sport, it was rotten, right? Where did it start? We need some more answers. I wish more people would come out and leave the ego and... it's okay you cheated. Just come on in.
Yeah.
We're going to give you a hug. Let's talk about what happened. Right? For the future generations of the sport, right?
In a way, they could reclaim their achievements and go, yeah, we did do it. And so I think it's really interesting for you to just remind everybody that in 1997, it was so filthy.
On the taxi ride over here, I told this, the driver that... In 1997, 210 starters in the Tour de France.
I'd be surprised if five were clean. And he was like, no way. I would think it would be the opposite. And he was an ex-cyclist, this guy.
Right.
So it wasn't just a few of us. There was, you know, it was the majority.
The bit where you are at your absolute limits and your doctor comes and goes, this isn't doping, it's health.
It's for your health.
It's like, it's such an easy thing. It's like, if you're, it's genius if you're a drug pusher. It's like, no, this isn't cheating. This is like, you frame that and then so your framework is completely skewed. Now,
but even the doctors, they, you know, this guy gave me my first, you know, doping product, a little red testosterone pill. You know, he was a good person. He was just, he was doing his job, you know. It was what had been going on for a long, long time.
And he legitimately felt he was helping you.
He did, yeah.
And in some ways, you can really, he can go home that night and go, geez, that Tyler was going off the rails there, but actually I've saved him now and he's going to have a great career. Like, that's what he can think, and that's his job.
Yeah.
That's how twisted and screwed up this whole thing is.
Yeah.
How do you fix it?
I don't know. I think it's, I'm far from the inside. I don't know what's going on there today, but I think it's cleaner today after, you know, the whole show that we put on, you know, the dark days of cycling. I would assume it's a lot cleaner, but obviously it's not perfect. There's guys still testing positive and I don't know, you know, and it's not just cycling.
Like, no, it's...
Let's be honest here.
It's football, it's American football,
It's pretty
basketball.
Much all the major sports. It's there. It's there. I've heard story. I do get out and talk once in a while about all this stuff. And after I'm done speaking, I get individuals that come up to me and quietly and whisper, you know, I've had anyone from bobsledders, soccer players, tennis players, track and field athletes.
Telling you about their own doping or people, right?
Yeah.
That must be an unintended consequence of writing a book like this. Where people come up and go, I'm trapped. How do I get out of this?
Yeah. Yeah. It's been interesting. But I think a lot of people look at this, you know, the story that I've told and feel like they wish they could tell their whole story too. But a lot of people, trapped is a good word. I felt pretty trapped for a long time.
I'm sure.
It's a great word for it. Yeah, I was trapped. Trapped in my own lies.
The Fuentes bit seems to be the darkest it gets, which is actually, so just to recap for people who are unfamiliar, you're with Lance Armstrong for a period of time, win a couple of Tours de France with him, get too good. And so they stop giving you the drugs because you're a bit of a threat to them, it seems. And then you get a job with Bjarne Riis, who is a champion doper himself, who's now in charge of a new team.
He won the Tour de France in 1996,
Blitzed the field, like with some epic performances that were kind of history making. And he tells you that he did it with a, did he take transfusions in 96?
That's what he told me.
Yeah. So like he's there kind of going, listen, Tyler, we've got to get you some of this cool blood stuff. And you secretly have actually already been on the blood stuff.
I'd done it once, on post-load the year 2000.
Although it hadn't had the desired impact at the time, or you hadn't fully understood the potential of it.
Yeah. I thought we were doing something way above and beyond at the time, but turns out that most teams, their sort of general classification leaders were doing it. So way more people were doing it than I thought. And when I arrived on CSC, it was like, we got to get you on this program. Hand me a phone number of this Spanish doctor who lives in Madrid. And I contacted him. We developed a relationship. And
that was Fuentes.
Ufimiano Fuentes, Ufe, as they call them.
Like, what I found remarkable about this whole thing is, well, first of all, if you come across a story at the time, the whole idea of blood bags is absolutely mental in itself. But, like, in your own story, the whole story of the bad blood bag, when you start to urinate black, I mean...
That was awful.
Like, last year was the 50th anniversary of Tom Simpson passing away as a result of amphetamines going up Vaughan 2, I think. Like, was there any part of you that felt like your own mortality coming to the fore there? Or was it literally, was your biggest worry not getting caught? Was it even more so than actually I could be in serious trouble here health-wise?
Yeah, honestly, this is how twisted it was. I was just pissed off that like I received a bad blood bag and it wasn't going to be effective. Yeah, that's kind of where I was at.
That's incredible levels of...
Yeah, I mean, you could tell it had gone bad. Yeah, basically in my urine was the dead red blood cells.
Yeah, so, it seemed...
yeah, I mean, I got a fever, and it could have been really bad. It could have been awful, but I knew, you know, you could feel it the next day it didn't work. And, you know, I could tell that something had gone wrong.
Yeah.
And maybe it had gotten sabotaged, you know, who knows.
You read the memoirs of addicts, and there's that dissonance between what the rest of the world sees and what they're living. And you definitely have a lot of that in this period.
It's like, yeah, for sure. Yeah, I was definitely, I needed to take 2 or 3 or 10 steps back and look at the big picture. But I was just so in it, you know. I was so motivated to try to win the Tour de France, to beat Lance. I thought, you know, I thought 2004 was the year, you know. The year before I got fourth, but I did it with had a cracked collarbone. And I thought 2004 was my year. You know, I had the right team behind me. Everything was perfect, so I thought, you know. And so, yeah, I needed to step away from the sport, you know. And luck, you know, finally, I got caught, and I did have to step away from the sport. Probably the best thing that ever, one of the best things that ever happened to me.
At that stage, the motivation was to beat Lance. That was it. That was like...
Well, just to win.
Yeah.
To win. You know, I mean, to beat Lance would have been icing on the cake.
What would winning have given you, do you think? Or what was...
It would have gotten worse then, you know? It would just been, you know, I would have gotten...
But if you put yourself back in 2004, Tyler's head, it's like, well, I'm doing all this with the purpose of winning. And when I do that, somehow salvation will be mine.
I don't know. Yeah, who knows what would have happened. Yeah, it just brought on more pressure, more, you know.
You're just part of a system.
Yeah, I was definitely part of the system. And you know, but I was a willing participant.
Sure.
A willing participant. And, you know, once I bought into it, I was like, okay, this is how it's done. And I just rolled up my sleeves. I looked the other way. I changed as a person. I knew the whole time it was wrong, but I was like, F it. I'm doing it. Like, this is how it's done. I saw how, you know, certain individuals did it. This is how we're going to do it. I got the backing from my team. Everybody was behind it. You know, everybody on the inside knew what was going on.
Yeah.
And supported it. Here we go.
You're our leader.
Let's do it.
And you're actually reaching peaks of greatness that you're capable of doing this.
Yeah, I mean, I was, you know, not far from... I was a Tour de France contender, you know, for sure.
Yeah.
Like, that could have become an all-time great summer. Tour de France winner, Olympics winner. Is there not a chance that, okay, put yourself back into the doper's position then, that the UCI is like, right, this guy is going to become the new Lance Armstrong. We are now going to engage in a fairly amicable relationship, and you might have called in a few favours that Lance did during his career. At that point then, the U-turn to becoming somebody who speaks out about this stuff would have been, like, you'd be beyond the point of no return at that point.
Yeah, who knows? Who knows? Mm-hmm. Who knows? Who knows? Yeah, I don't know, but I feel lucky that it stopped. It stopped abruptly. Yeah, it was pretty painful, obviously, at the time. I was in just a daze for a long time. Like, is this really happening? And then, yeah, it took some time, but yeah, here I am.
And
I never thought I'd be in this position. I never thought I'd be a professional cyclist. Just when I got the green light that I was going to start the tour, that I made the selection to be in the tour within my team. You know, I called my parents and I said, you know, come over early because I don't know if I'll finish. And this is probably my first and last one. I'll probably be back in school next year. I had no idea where it was going. But yeah, it kind of felt like a wild dream.
Yeah. I mean, it was though, like, again, people forget this, but so Le Monde happens and cycling in America is supposed to explode.
Yeah, that was cool.
And
that was...
it explodes a little bit at kind of grassroots level,
yeah.
But it really crosses over into the mainstream when Nike get behind Lance. And the first Tour de France that he wins, you guys are in like a rented, beat up.
Yeah, we call ourselves the Bad News Bears. That was a pretty cool tour, like, you know, under the circumstances, it was, we weren't expected to win. You know, they said Lance was strong, but he had a poor team behind him. And so, yeah, we had, most teams had the big buses. And we had 2 rented campers.
Are you Paniagua in that race?
No.
No, you're, okay, so.
EPO.
EPO.
Yep, yep. And we
There's
had a motoman then.
Yeah, okay, so that's the motoman one.
Yep, so it was Lance's gardener would drop off syringes of EPO to the team staff.
To microdose.
This is the year after the Festina affair.
Okay, so
nobody's going to be carrying it in their car. So after the Festina affair, things went underground.
Yeah, and that's when it actually becomes the individual responsibility of the cyclist to dope.
Yeah, I mean, their team was still involved, but
sure,
to a lesser degree. They had to keep their hands sort of clean.
Plausible deniability. And also, but really, it's like they can scapegoat you at any point as opposed to them taking it. It's a brilliant corporate move.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Yeah. We just found a different way to do it. You know, and other teams did this, had their types of motoman as well. You know, I heard some riders just kept it in their suitcases.
And that was as easy as that.
Took the chance. Yeah. Just took the chance.
And there was no more buses.
So we weren't going to do that because, you know, the year before they were actually raiding hotels and raiding riders' rooms and checking their suitcases. So we were smarter than that.
Yeah, yeah. And more adventurous.
It seems so like, we had motoman.
It seems like that was the perfect timing. Like Festina just happened the year before, whereas after a couple of years of you guys at the peak of US Postal, no other team could really infiltrate the peloton to the level that you had, because Lance had a private jet. You could fly your EPO and your jet if you wanted to, or even your blood bags, rather.
Yeah.
Whereas other teams still had to cross borders and all that sort of stuff.
Right.
They needed to get really rich to do what you were doing very, very well. And you were so dominant, and you had the transportation of the drugs off to such a tee that you weren't going to allow them to penetrate your success.
Yeah, we weren't going to be denied. That was sort of the mentality. For sure. You can love him or hate him, but Lance, you know, I like to win, but Lance really had to win. He, second to me, was really good, but he didn't like to finish in second. So he was the most motivated person that I saw ever that wanted to win was Lance.
People are still obsessed with him. Like, and I guess even last week is maybe an end to, in some degree, of... I remember thinking... It had been such a long time since he'd been in the news, and then going back to do some research on the interview, I was like, oh, now I remember why everybody thinks he's such a dick and why he appears to be evil so often. Because you have to remember all the stuff that he pulls, all the people that he bullies along the way, all the lives that he ruins and the people that he threatens and the aggression that he goes at people. That'll pass over a period of time. Everybody just go, oh, that was that guy. What was his? He's a celebrity. He's just a cyclist.
Right.
You know? That's the pity, I think, of what's happened.
And why he's moving on.
And why it's important for you to keep telling your story, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not here just, you know. Obviously, Lance and I have our stuff. You know, we're not friends anymore. I certainly don't hate him. I used to hate him, hate his guts. I don't hate him anymore. I've forgiven him in my own sort of way.
He didn't speak to you after Oprah or around Oprah, did he?
But I'm not here to talk, just, you know.
No.
I'm just here to share my story and, you know, tell the truth about, you know, what can happen if you don't really think about long-term consequences.
I think the obsession, there's two things there. The winning at all costs, which I would like to hear you to talk about before we wrap up. But the other thing is that USADA had promised everybody that this wasn't just going to be, we're just going to go get Lance and that's all, or a couple of cyclists. It's going to be, we're going to try and change the culture of the sport. And WADA, exactly the same. But effectively, WADA has proven to be a bit of a waste of time and money. And I'm not really sure if I hold USADA in any esteem at the end of this whole process either, in that they did just go after Lance, and they didn't really have material impact, it seems to me, on the impact on the sports culture.
It's tough to say. You know, we've come along. Let's not forget that, you know, these organizations didn't exist, you know, 15, 20 years ago. They've come a long ways. And, you know, there wasn't even an EPO test back in 99. It didn't come about till the year 2000. I think USADA finally got, you know, they started out, I think, in the early 2000s, and I think Travis Tiger told me they didn't get into really full steam until maybe the mid 2000s. So they've made they've come a long ways. They still have a long ways to go, but you know, it's tough. There's the dopers are usually, and the doping doctors and are usually a step or two ahead. And, you know, they have a tough road ahead of them. So they got to keep working hard and You know, I support them both, WADA and USADA.
Yeah, okay. So you think they're doing, they could be better, but they're doing, yeah, they're getting there.
Yeah. We got to support them. We got to give them encouragement, you know.
We're pretty obsessed with the idea of motors in the peloton on this show. Obviously, we got Lance on the record about it and then talked to the guy who invented the motor that's small enough to fit in. You did the documentary where the motor can clearly fit in the bikes.
Oh, yeah.
Do you think it's credible that there has been in the past the use of motors in the biggest stage races in the world, in the Tour de France? Is it something that you think could have happened?
I think it could have. You know, after I did a little interview with 60 Minutes and they showed me what it's all about and how small and inconspicuous it can be. I was surprised.
Were you? Like,
yeah, when I was a cyclist, I never had heard about it. And then all of a sudden, you know, I think 2008, 2009, you started hearing about it. And there were certain videos out there that looked pretty interesting.
Yeah. And there's loads more. Now that the stuff on YouTube comes up, you're like, well, hang on.
Yeah, there's some stuff that makes you definitely scratch your head. And there's been a rider or two that have been caught.
So. Yeah.
I do have a few inside sources, and from what I've heard, yeah, it's been used at the biggest races in the world.
Yeah.
By big riders.
So I think they're testing bikes to a certain extent now. We have no idea to what extent that's happening. Were any of your bikes ever tested during your cycling career?
No, not that I know of, no.
So if that technology was available back then, and you mentioned the fact that, like, say the Motoman version of whatever that would be for motorized doping, it was every cyclist for themselves, every team for themselves, that would suggest that it could well have been happening in the peloton without your knowledge.
It could have, yeah. I didn't know anything about it or hear anything about it back then, but it could certainly could have happened. After what I saw in that 60 Minutes program that they showed me what it's all about.
I
tried it out. It was pretty cool.
Was it? Yeah.
Yeah.
And so here's the question.
And I was not fit, and I went up a climb pretty fast. Yeah.
If I come to you when you're, like, you're on the side of the road, there's a brilliant story about you being on the side of the road, and, like, you feel this kind of torrent, and you look down, and you're... the wound from the blood transfusion hasn't healed, and you're it's like, if I'd come to you in that street corner and said, here, listen, you don't need to do that anymore, I've got this little thing, you just slip it in your back wheel, no one's ever going to know, would you have motor doped?
I don't think so.
Really? That's the line.
Who knows, back then, like, I mean, I was pretty, you know, I was so in it, who knows, but I don't think so.
Why not?
That just seems like a whole another level. You know,
taking your own blood out, storing it.
That's, you know, that's, I mean? Not much better. Not that I was some angel or anything.
No, I know, but that's like, true, so this is, know, these but, are the but philosophical.
You know, if you have enough people telling me that it's like the right thing to do,
those guys over there, they have it.
And they're all doing it too. Like, who knows?
Yeah.
Who knows? Yeah.
But it
feels, I would
like
to think I would say no, absolutely not.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure I would have.
Okay.
But, you know, who knows?
Yeah, the context is hard. Well, you now obviously would.
Yeah, it just seems like another let's doping times two almost.
Yeah. Because there is a code. There's a weird code that runs through the book. There's like periods of the book where you're pissed off. We were talking about this earlier. You're pissed off at Lance for talking smack about you in the peloton.
Oh, yeah.
There's a possibility that he's ratted you out to whoever.
He did.
Like, I mean, you're less pissed off with him about ratting you out than you are about him talking smack. There's like a hierarchy here of, like, I can't believe he's talking about me bad in the peloton. But he's just told the UCI that he thinks you're doping.
Go get that guy. Yeah.
Like, that code is it's still part of that cyclist who you are. That's the cyclist identity. That some things are okay and some things are...
Right. Yeah, we're all a little bit twisted.
Yeah, it's
for
true.
Sure, for sure. But I don't know. I mean, I've heard so many different stories about, well, outside of sport, I've heard stories about people in Wall Street and how just, you know, they get so into something and they're, you know, before they know it, they're so deep in it, you know, way past the gray zone into the black zone. And yeah, it can happen. You know, just little by little, it's a snowball effect. Before you know it, you know, that little red egg, that little red testosterone pill I took in the spring of, 1997, you know, it was a little speck of dirt on my shoe, you know. Little did I know, you know, years later, I'd be, like, up to my neck in mud.
Yeah.
I had no idea where that was leading. You know, had I known that back in 97, where it was going, I think I would have been on that first flight back to Boston, you know.
that is the win at all costs mentality. Yeah. That's why, that's what the culture, it's a big debate in Irish sport at the minute. There's like a real fear that we're losing sight of some core values, and that we've just decided that ultimately nothing matters apart from victory.
Yeah.
And it's led to some pretty ugly situations. And I think that certainly anybody who reads the book thinks, it's okay to finish second or just to do your best.
What's wrong with finishing 52nd? You know, as long as you gave your best, right? You know, I was watching the Olympics this, what was it, recently, and it's not about the U.S., it's like not about how many medals we win, it's about all about how many gold medals we win. It's just, I don't know, it's kind of disgusting. And then, you know, I don't know if you saw the movie Icarus.
Yeah.
But it's getting bad. And like, how many Icaruses were there out there that we don't know about? You know, I mean, there's plenty of story. Like, it's just the tip of the iceberg, I think.
What did you make of Icarus?
You know, and, you know, this is just the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah.
You know, there's plenty more. There's 1,000 different secret races out there.
What did you make of watching, when you were watching Icarus, were you, like,
I mean, great film. Great, I mean, incredible, incredible story. Jaw-dropping, really. Yeah, I don't know. I was a little bit naive, I guess. I didn't think it would go up to that level. It did.
Yeah.
It did.
It's like, because
you know, to what degree do you will you go to win?
It turns
ugly. It makes, I don't know, it makes you not really want to compete. Like, I don't know, I'm kind of disgusted by competition a little bit. Not disgusted, that's not
that, but
word,
the, so, but,
you know, I don't know, I'm not competing ever again in my life.
Right.
You know, I like to enjoy sport, be a tourist.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Yeah, I was riding back from my cycling trip on the West Coast the other day, and I was going through this town. They were playing a Gaelic football.
Gaelic football,
game?
Yeah.
Galway versus Mayo.
Oh yeah, Galway Mayo, yeah.
And man, you could feel the hatred between the two teams. You know?
Were you at us?
No, I didn't. But I was riding my bike like right. I rode right by the stadium, and yeah, you could feel just the energy. Like it was pretty wild. But yeah, I was kind of just thinking about the sport in general. And
well, so it's Gaelic football, really, that people are concerned that the win-at-all-cost mentality is seeping into the whole sport of GAA. And
oh, really?
You're hiving off kids at the age of 12 and saying, okay, you're an elite Gaelic footballer. You're going to be part of this elite training squad and we'll take you away from your clubs. And then you stay that the whole way up to the time that you're 22 and then you fall out of love with the game because you've been flogged and actually don't really have an exterior life. And that people are concerned that that's not necessarily the right way to do things.
Yeah.
We're prioritizing the elite over the fact that the clubs that those 12-year-olds come from is an amateur club where parents go with their children to meet other parents who are like-minded and to get their kids out and have a bit of a run around.
Yeah.
And we're a sports program. We love elite sport and love watching it. But at the same time, very concerned about the fact that maybe we don't really worry too much about the people who are being offered the red pill and going, well, why wouldn't I take it?
Right, right. Yeah, and back in the States, the pressure to for kids these days is, you know, greater than ever. Kids these days have to pick a sport, you know. They can no longer do three sports when they're 12, 13 years old. They got to pick their sport, you know, when they're super young. And if not, they're not getting in with the right squad and they're not getting all the right opportunities, so they got to pick, and you know, that's terrible. They should be able to do five different sports,
totally,
whatever they want, just have fun with it. It doesn't matter.
Do you think you'd dope again if you were that person that, like, the circumstances haven't changed enough for you? You point you made earlier. If I'd known what I know now, I got back on the plane to Boston, but there's no way to teach all the 18-year-olds when. For your health.
Yeah, would I dope again had I known what I know?
No. Obviously, you couldn't know what you know, but do you think enough has changed in the world that today, Tyler Hamilton...
I don't think so. I don't think enough's changed. Yeah. And that bothers me. You know, I do, you know, I've come a long ways and have peeled a lot of the layers of onion off and... feel like a lot better person today, but what still bugs me is, have we done enough to move forward and to say, okay, like, yeah, we can close the door on the past and move forward now and do that with our head held high. You know, I don't think we have.
No.
I think we need to dig a little bit more. And like, you know, like I said before, drop our egos, come out, be honest, and like, let's do it for the future generations, not of just cycling, but of all sport, right? We got to figure out a way. It's getting, the pressures are getting higher and higher.
You feel comfortable having that role as an activist, effectively? That, like, there's a lot of talk about athlete activism at the moment, particularly in the States, and like, you know,
I don't know how to go about it, but yeah, I'd be happy to. I'd be happy to. You know, I'm sort of persona non grata in the sport of cycling.
Well, that's good. That's a good starting point.
Is it?
That's the perfect starting point. Only people who are PNG can actually kind of have some
PNG
persona non grata.
I like that.
Kind of have some credibility when it comes to this.
Will you help me?
Totally, yeah.
Okay.
Whatever we can do.
Owen, you in?
Oh, 100%.
All right, we got three.
Nice one.
Three.
We got Floyd on board as well.
All right, Floyd's in.
Just from listening to you for the last, whatever, 40 minutes or however long this has been going on for, you clearly still love cycling. I mean, it's the very negative things that you dislike. We pointed it out. And talking about the secret race, talking about Icarus, the key components of those and the two things that link it are the people that spoke. There is no guarantee that whatever's happened in the, that whatever we've seen in cycling and other sports is clean over the past decade. There is also no guarantee that we're going to see another Gregory Rodchenkov, another Floyd Landis, another Tyler Hamilton who will actually speak out about this, because it does seem as many leap forwards as the authorities have made. Without a whistleblower in these situations, we will never know the full truth.
Yeah, it helps to certainly have a whistleblower for sure. Yeah, I don't know if we've come, that far. It still bothers me. Like, I mean, you know, I do have a lot of respect for WADA and USADA, but I think we still have a lot of room to go. You know, we can dig deeper. You know, let's figure out how it all went wrong, really.
Yeah.
Right?
Go to the start. See what the methods were.
Yeah. I mean, I know people want to just look ahead and keep going forward, but like,
that's pointless.
Like, it's, yeah, we got to look back and figure out where things went wrong, how it went wrong. And
we could start a podcast called Backwards. That'd be people might get the joke. Tyler, you've been really good with your time. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on your show.
We'll do that cycle in the west of Ireland sometime soon.
Okay.
That's a deal.
Really? I'm putting you down on it.
Yeah, no, that's a deal.
All right, 5-6 days.
Yeah, cool. We can do that.
Each of you.
Yeah.
Right, we'll raise some money for a good cause.
Yeah, we can do that.
Okay.
That was an OTB Podcast Network presentation.